from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Now, back to the courtroom.
All right, you may be seated.
I was just told that there's no
other. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
Sir, I wanted to ask you first off, I think your conclusion, what you stated earlier, is that based on your expert review of that Baldwin revolver, the shooter had to have fully cocked that weapon and pulled that trigger to cause it to fire. Is that? Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. Let me start over, if it's okay, Your Honor. Okay. Sir, if I can ask that again, I think your conclusion, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that the Baldwin revolver that you examined, in your expert opinion, that the shooter had to have fully cocked that weapon and had to have pulled that trigger all the way, pulled the trigger to fire it?
Yes, on the first part. I bifurcated my answer in the report. Either pull the trigger, which I regard as a volitional act, or have already depressed it.
Yes, sir.
Already depressed it, the very instant he let go of the hammer, it would fire.
So, sir, for example, if Mr. Baldwin were cross-drawing that weapon and had his finger in the trigger guard, and then he pulled it and it had it fully cocked and it slipped and let go, would that fire that weapon?
Only if he had the trigger pulled or depressed. They're okay. Similar, but I make a slight distinction between it being depressed versus pulled.
Okay, so, sir, so either way, that shooter had to either have it depressed, have his finger in the trigger, or pull that trigger for that to fire.
And have it cocked.
And have it cocked.
Fully cocked.
Fully cocked.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, now, I noticed earlier when you were doing a demonstration with the jury, you exercised extreme muzzle discipline, I'm gonna call it. You learned that, correct? Not to ever point that weapon at an individual, a human?
Long ago.
Yes, sir. Been around guns a long time?
I have.
And one of the most important rules, and I saw when you walked down, you had it either down, up, it was never pointed at a person. That's one of the most important rules of gun safety, isn't it?
I agree.
Okay. And sir, another rule that I noticed when your son was on that video, and when you were demonstrating, you never had your finger in that trigger guard. Is that another rule you learned from a long time ago?
Well, we were demonstrating something there which had... in which the trigger saved the gun from firing. If we had depressed it, of course, it wouldn't be a useful demonstration.
No, and I understand. My question wasn't good. You never put your finger in that trigger guard until you were ready to pull that trigger in some manner.
Yes.
Okay. Now, with regard to the cross draw, and I know you've been around guns for a long time, but with regard to the cross draw, would you agree that somebody that was not familiar with that draw would need to have training on that draw?
You'd have to have some understanding of where the firearm is, how the holster works, whether it's got a safety strap or not, and then, of course, get it out of that area and swing it around, as was shown in the videos that I've looked at of Mr. Baldwin.
Yes, sir. And did you see the video where, when he pulls it out, his finger is in the trigger guard? Did you see that?
I certainly did.
And again, that can be very dangerous, sir, based on your expert conclusion, if he has that fully cocked, correct?
And it's loaded and fully cocked, yes.
Yes, sir. And so when you watched that video, did you make a determination as to whether he should have drawn that with his finger in the trigger guard?
It's been a while since I've looked at it. I was trying to decide a couple of other things. If that's the evidence gun, I was satisfied it was because of the plain bare metal hammer. And then, of course, looking at, can I really determine if his finger's inside the trigger guard but not on the trigger itself? I could never never resolved that.
Okay.
Because of the camera angle.
And in any event, you should not have your finger on the trigger in that cross draw.
Well, it doesn't matter what it's a cross draw. It's if you're going to cock the gun, which he did after it's out. I do remember that. Yeah. When it's out of the holster, you can see him cocking it. It's now clear of the holster. But we're back to, or I'm back to, I can't tell if he's already got the trigger depressed or it gets pulled later.
Okay, sir. And with regard to your conclusion, I want to make sure I was clear on that. I know that you, and I don't want to use the word critical, but you didn't think that aggressive testing by the FBI was a good idea?
I didn't think it was necessary in this case, given the context. What are the issues in the case? In my mind, it was never an issue that the hammer got struck by anything or that the gun got dropped.
And so you didn't believe that the FBI even needed to do that test?
From my viewpoint, no. Okay. It was not a useful or necessary test to strike the hammer of the fully cocked evidence gun.
Did you also say that you did not find any damage to that weapon that would have prevented it from firing as designed? And I'm talking about not after the FBI, but prior. Is that your conclusion?
Yes, that if the hammer were replaced and the trigger replaced and the bolt, it was a perfectly functioning, authentic replica of a classic firearm.
Okay, sir, and in your inspection of that weapon, that Baldwin revolver, did you see any modifications that would have changed the firing characteristics of that weapon?
No, not at all. In fact, I went through, I think there are 12 other revolvers. 9 of them are Pietas. And I took them all apart with the help of my younger son, Mike, and we looked at the sears, the triggers, the full cock notches, and they were all equivalent. You could have swapped them out because they're carefully manufactured parts. So that's how I addressed and answered that question in my own mind.
Okay, sir. So other than the FBI testing, breaking those components, you didn't see any other evidence of modification or damage?
I did not.
Okay, sir. With regard to the rounds that you were talking about, the Starline brass is used by hand loaders at times. Hand loaders use Starline brass, is that true?
Yes, that's their primary market. I'm one of their consumers. Small ammunition companies like the one in the box of ammunition that the prosecutor showed earlier have also used their brass. Remington, Winchester, they of course have their own.
So, and can you tell the jury, a hand loader, if they use, they can use any type of primer, any type of powder, any type of bullet in a case, right? In
the hand loader? No, that's definitely not true.
Okay, what is a?
Well, let's start with the primer. That's the spark plug in your car. It's the spark plug in ammunition. There are large pistol primers and there are small pistol primers. The Colt cartridge requires a large pistol primer. There are also rifle primers that have the same dimensions, but they're harder and usually have more explosive in them. The same way there's small rifle primers. So you got 4 types. Then they could be plain brass, if that's your pleasure for aesthetics, or nickel plated. And I've seen them both ways. So we got 4 types and 2 finishes. There are even some that are custom for bench rest shooting and other exotic competition, but those are the 4 main. The powders, yet another thing. They're powders that are specifically manufactured for handguns. You've got a big bore and a heavy bullet that's got to be accelerated in a short distance. So those powders have to burn very fast and produce their energy. Rifle powders, if you shoot a 30-30 or a 30-06, you couldn't take the powder that's in one of your rifle cartridges and put it in a pistol cartridge and get it to work. It'd basically fizzle or squib. They burn it. It's like sawdust, sticks, and logs. Powders burn at different rates for shotguns, pistols, and rifles. So there's a lot of thought that's gone into this over the last century and a half of how you make all this come together to not blow up the gun, to achieve the desired pressure and velocity, and of course, produce an accurate shot.
Yes, sir. And so did you have any evidence when you looked at the live rounds from the rust set that those were hand loads or those were some other type? Did you determine that?
Well, they're in Starline brass, which is sold for hand loaders. But as I said, a commercial manufacturer can buy Starline brass, just as you saw in that one box. The bullets look more amateurish to me. In fact, I have that same bullet with a blue lube, and it's a cast bullet. Doesn't come in cartridges. So I don't have a definitive answer on you. They were virgin cases. That means they hadn't been fired previously and then reloaded. They were shiny inside. So they were first time assembled, and the powder, their physical forms, just as I've mentioned, looked like a powder called Bullseye, which is probably the oldest pistol powder around. It's very popular. I use it myself. It's normally associated with hand loaders, but it doesn't stop the industry from buying a ton of it and loading a few million rounds.
Okay, sir. So you didn't make a definitive determination, but those rounds appeared amateurish, which would be more like a hand load. Is that fair?
Yes, that has kind of a demeaning character to it. I pride myself on my hand loads, and they looked fine, but they'd already been disassembled, so I didn't get to see the quality of the crimp and just where the crimp was made. That's where you hold the bullet in the cartridge case. I wished I'd seen them before they were disassembled.
But when you looked at it, it did appear, I'm just trying to establish, it did appear more likely to be a hand load.
Yes.
Okay. And if I could, if we could have Gunner, if I may approach the witness.
Are you going to mark that?
This is State's Exhibit 110. This
All
has
right.
already been
no objections.
Yes.
Okay. It's already been admitted into evidence. Oh, yeah. If we can put. With this, Mr. Haig, I hope you can see this.
Yes, I can.
Okay, do you see this is State's Exhibit 110 that's been introduced? Have you ever seen this photo?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, let me get that. So, Mr. Haig, on the right, that you're looking at right now, I have it under it. What is that type of powder?
It's a pistol powder. In my opinion, it's one called Trail Boss. That's a brand name. Designed for cowboy action loads in handgun, centerfire handgun cartridges. And its characteristic shape, as I say, it looks like little donuts or tires if you magnify it. And it's a dull gray. It's also what's called a single base powder. So I use it myself. It's an old friend. It works well.
Okay, sir. And now I'm going to move this over, and I'm going to show you this other type of powder. And what do you call that type of powder?
Of the many physical forms, it's called disc flake. That's with a hyphen, disc flake. It's little flakes in the sharp shape of discs, like little gray hockey pucks under the microscope. And without a scale, I couldn't compare that any further to, say, Bullseye or some of the other disc flake powders.
Okay, and now I'm gonna try to zoom in here. Do you see in the middle of the ones you just described, you see that donut looking shape right in the middle?
I see it. I don't see it as a powder particle. It's something in the holding device.
And by holding device, what do you mean by that?
I don't know. I didn't have benefit of having this in my hand to actually empty it out, as I recall. Okay. So I don't know what it is. It's not powder, that's all.
You don't think it's powder?
I'm convinced it is not a propellant or powder.
Okay, but you don't recall that particular thing when you looked at it, or when you had it? Or what did you just say? I didn't understand.
If I looked at it, I was again, firsthand, I was again interested in the propellant as to whether I could identify it on the basis of morphology, and I didn't get anywhere beyond it's a disc flake powder popularly used in pistol cartridges, handgun cartridges.
Okay. Sir, as part of your work in this case, did you ever see the photographs from PDQ Props from Seth Kenney's business?
I know I saw a number of photographs after a a production of materials there, search warrant, I suppose you'd call it, and a lot of the ammunition, plus the FBI did a lot of x-ray images of cartridges from that facility.
Did you remember the way that that place looked in terms of its organization or disorganization?
Only vaguely.
Okay. All right. And we may show you some pictures of that, but you never went there personally.
I have not been there.
Okay. And you've had no contact with Seth Kinney yourself.
That's also correct. I don't know the man. I've not met him.
Okay. Did you, with regard to the rounds on Seth, did you measure or inspect all of the rounds? For example, we've been evidence there's been 250 dummy rounds. Did you go through all of those?
Over a period of 5 days, yes.
Okay. And did you go through all of the live rounds, you said?
Yes, definitely. Okay. Looked at the all disassembled, but five rounds.
Okay. And other than what you told us, anything else about those live rounds? You did tell us the blue loop. Any other matters that you investigated that you determined about those?
Well, I probably said earlier this morning, those are hard to cast, meaning the lead has been hardened. It's not dead soft lead like you'd get out of an x-ray machine. Cast bullets, there's another way you can make bullets that the manufacturers do, but casting with a mold, bullet mold. And yes, I now must recall, the propellant in the disassembled live rounds looked like the powder I mentioned, bullseye. And I didn't see that in other sources in this case.
Now, sir, can you tell the jury what a light strike misfire is, if that term's familiar to you?
Yes, I'd usually separate the terms, but let's just start with a misfire is a cartridge fails to fire for some reason. A light strike could be one of those reasons. That means the hammer didn't fall its full distance, or it was retarded by something. It was going to fall, but something got caught up in it. Or the example I gave earlier, and I did it with the actual evidence gun, pull the hammer back with real ammunition, pull the hammer back to the quarter cock, that little distance where the safety would set, but I had the trigger depressed, and then let the hammer fall. That would make it be actually hard to see, a little tick mark, T-I-C-K, a little tick mark in the primer, but it wouldn't fire it.
And observing that after that happened, if you observed that round and you could see that little strike in the primer, is it true that round could still go off the next hit?
Yes. If it didn't fire and a primer had a tick mark, one of these little light indentations in it, and you put it back in the firearm and drew the hammer all the way back, it's going to fire.
And sir, one other area on the, you mentioned that the gun barrel, Baldwin revolver, that it was dirty.
Well, it had to be dirty when the evidence bullet went down the barrel.
Okay. And let me just ask you, does it take some time for an individual to properly clean a gun that's been firing black powder?
Whether black powder, I saw no evidence black powder was used in this case, but I know what you mean. There's a substitute called 777. Which acts like black powder. They both leave a lot of residue in the gun barrel. And it can be difficult to get out, especially if you don't know what you're doing, because it's largely water-soluble. And modern powders, like you just showed me in the picture, are not water-soluble. So you need to know, okay, this is 777 or black gunpowder, and I've got to get this stuff out. You're going to have to scrub it out with hot, soapy water is the best way, and then dry the gun barrel out.
Okay, sir, and I know you, I appreciate that. I know you operate a business. Were you paid or compensated in this case for your work?
For my time, of course.
Yes, sir. And how much have you been compensated?
Well, my wife handles the bookkeeping, so I don't know for sure. But there's been quite a few hours. As I said, 5 days just looking at all this evidence alone. Then another when I came over here in July to look at the clothing. And then in August for the videos you saw. So there's 5, 6, 7, 8 or so days.
And what's your hourly rate?
$350 per hour.
Okay. Okay, and I thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Redirect.
Mr. Haig, did you look at all of the disassembled live rounds from the set of Rust.
Yes.
Did any of the primers on those live rounds have those tick marks?
No.
And just to be clear, when we were looking at photos earlier, the photo of the ammunition that came from PDQ Props, you described that bullet as a semi-wad cutter.
Yes.
Okay. And can you definitively say that the live rounds from the set of Rust were kind of homemade sort of reloads as opposed to the HSM brand that we looked at on the photos that you and your son purchased?
Yeah, I wouldn't demean that ammunition to that degree. There's just it's subtle, but if you shoot all the time and load ammunition, I recognize them as, in all likelihood, hand loads. I wouldn't describe them as shoddy or poorly made or sometimes I'll see dents in cartridge cases and the bullet's been improperly seated. So nothing wrong with them. They look like perfectly suitable hand loads. I've seen prettier. I've sure seen a lot worse.
Are you, I just want to be clear, are you testifying to the jury that you don't believe that those rounds that were found on the set would have come from a small manufacturer like HSM?
I can't rule it out, but the ammunition I've purchased in 45 Colt from various manufacturers and those that my younger son Mike has purchased have a higher quality. The bullets are slicker, shinier.
Okay. And you were asked some questions on cross-examination about gun safety and Mr. Baldwin having his finger in the trigger guard of that gun. You recall those questions?
I do.
Based on your review of the evidence in this case, is it your understanding that Mr. Baldwin was told that the gun was cold or inert before he put his finger in the trigger guard?
Yes. It's my understanding from reading the documents, the call cold gun was given, meaning there's a gun on the set, but there's nothing in it that's going to fire. No blanks or, of course, live rounds.
And the dummies in this case that rattled, you examined some of those, didn't you?
Yes, I did, a number of them.
Do you mind my asking, sir, how old you are?
83.
And, sir, with your 83-year-old ears, were you able to clearly hear the rattle?
Not always.
Not always.
Especially in my right ear.
Okay. Yeah. Do you think that's an issue with your hearing?
I thought it was subtle even when I listened with my good ear, my left ear.
The rattle was subtle.
Yes.
So in order to hear that rattle, you have to listen pretty closely, right?
Yes, and it gets more complicated. Some of them had one pellet in them, others had two or three. So now you've got the advantage, if you happen to pull one that's got three in it, better opportunity to hear it rattle.
Okay. Sir, are you familiar with the term inertia bullet puller?
Sure.
Can you tell us what that is?
Yes, it's a very simple device. It looks a little bit like a hammer, only it's clear plastic. It's got a cap, and you put usually a live cartridge, or maybe one that's failed to fire. Anyway, it's a cartridge. It's got a bullet, cartridge case, primer. Put it in this device, and you hit it on a hard surface. Good old Isaac Newton works out for us. The hammer stops, and the heavy bullet keeps on going. Now, it may take three or four hits, but you separate the bullet from the cartridge in a non-destructive way, so you get the bullet, you get all the powder, and you get a cartridge case. It's pretty routine if we want to know, what's this ammunition loaded with, how much powder, what kind of bullet? Because we can't see all the bullet when it's in the cartridge case. So it's a common tool. I think I have two or three of them.
So the inertia puller is a device that is designed to disassemble live ammunition. Is that right?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. I don't have anything else.
All right, thank you, sir. You're excused. Next witness.
We will call Corporal Alex Hancock.
Where's the
deputy?
Just a minute. Let's get this off. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Raise your hand.
Do you swear affirm under penalty of law that the testimony you'll give in this case will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Have a seat.
Detective Hancock, go ahead and state your name for the record.
Alexandria Hancock.
How are you currently employed?
I am currently a corporal with the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office.
How long have you been employed at the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office?
A little over 6 years now.
And have you only worked at the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office?
Yes.
Okay. On October 21st, 2021, what was your position with the department?
So on October 21st, 2021, I was a detective in the Criminal Investigations Division, and I was assigned to the Violent Crimes Division.
And how did you become involved in this case?
I became involved in the Rust case. We were working that day and in the office, and got notified that there was a shooting on a movie set.
And when you received that information, what did you do?
So we met essentially as a team in investigations. And at that point, we had essentially split up assignments. We do this with any sort of major case, like a homicide, shooting, stabbing, anything like that. So we'll meet with the supervisors and then the entire team. And then at that point, we'll divvy up essentially who's going to do what at that time.
Tell us how you divvied things up.
So at the initial point of this case, there was actually another detective that was assigned the primary, and I was assigned as secondary. So what that means is that the primary is pretty much the head of the investigation. They're essentially in charge of what's going to happen, and then they divvy up responsibilities for the rest of the team from there.
And who was that person who was originally assigned primary?
His name is Joel Connell.
And is he a colleague of yours?
Yes, yes.
And at some point, was that designation changed, and were you assigned primary?
Yes, about 2 weeks later.
On October 21st, just so that we understand who was doing what, can you give us the names of the people that you yourself interviewed on the 21st of October?
Yeah, so the day of the incident, I was assigned to take some individuals back to the sheriff's office to be interviewed. Those individuals involved Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, who is here in the courtroom today, David Halls, and Alec Baldwin.
And those are the three people who ultimately were criminally charged in this case, correct?
That is correct.
Would you agree with me that you did the primary interviews on October 21st?
Yes.
And so while you were interviewing kind of the main players on October 21st, what was Detective Cano doing?
So Detective Cano had stayed at the ranch, so at the Bonanza Creek Ranch, and it was my understanding that there were additional people who were inside of the church at the time that the incident happened that he had interviewed and had assistance from another detective. So essentially they stayed on scene and used a like a movie trailer or whatever was designated towards them to interview all those other people.
And why were you guys interviewing people at the same time? You in one location, him in another location?
Because of the amount of people that we had to interview, and at the sheriff's office we only have one interview room.
Now, you were present in the courtroom when Officer LaFleur and Mr. Benavidez testified. Do you recall that?
Yes.
What's your opinion with regard to their sentiments that this was a difficult scene because of the number of people?
Yeah, I would say it produced a pretty big problem for the sheriff's office just because of the fact that there were so many people on this movie scene, hundreds of people, and there were so few of us at the time.
Now, in addition to interviewing Mr. Baldwin, Ms. Gutierrez, and Mr. Halls on October 21st, 2021, did you also conduct a subsequent interview with Ms. Gutierrez?
Yes, I did.
And was her attorney, Mr. Bowles, present for that interview?
Yes, he was.
And did you have numerous subsequent telephone conversations with Mr. Baldwin?
Yes, quite a few.
At any point in time after October 21st, did you conduct an interview of a witness by the name of Sarah Zachary?
Yes, I did handle her initial interview was with Detective Cano, and then I had a follow-up interview with her sometime in November with her attorney.
And did you also conduct an interview with an actor by the name of Jensen Ackles?
Yes, I did.
Did you conduct an interview with the witness that we heard from earlier, Catherine Rowe Walters?
Yes.
And did you interview a gentleman by the name of Zach Sills?
Yes.
Did you interview a gentleman by the name of Seth Kinney?
Numerous times.
And when you say numerous times, how many times do you think you spoke to Mr. Kinney?
Over five.
And did you interview a gentleman by the name of Thel Reed?
Yes, I did.
Let's start with Mr. Reed. How did you come to conduct an interview, and just to be clear, I think it was telephonic, is that right?
Yes, it was.
How did you come to conduct an interview with Mr. Reed?
So my initial, I guess the way that I had originally heard about Mr. Thel Reed was that he was Hannah's father, and Jason Bowles, Hannah's attorney, had actually brought him up after the second interview that I had conducted with Hannah, essentially saying that Thel wanted to provide a statement as to where the live ammunition may have come from on set. Jason had emailed me a...
When you say Jason, you mean Jason Bowles?
Yes, Jason Bowles. Had emailed me a typed out statement, and at the bottom of this statement, it had Thel's name on it. At that time, I had advised to Jason that that would not be a sufficient statement for me because I hadn't conducted the interview myself, and that essentially a word typed statement, not signed, not really identified from anybody, would not be sufficient for me. So I had discussed with Mr. Jason Bowles that if Thel wanted to provide an actual statement to me, that we needed to set up an interview.
And did he do that?
Yes, he did the following day.
And did you interview him?
Yes.
Was that prior to asking the court to authorize a search warrant on PDQ props?
Yeah, it was about a week before.
And under what circumstances did you become aware of Seth Kinney in a manner that caused you to start to have to interview him and interact with him?
So from the beginning of the investigation, my first interactions with Seth Kinney came from the search warrant that we had done on the prop truck, which was on the set of Rust. I had essentially told Seth, or had communications with him, that I was going to need to get inside the safe on the prop truck, which is where we were told that they had stored guns. And instead of breaking open this safe, We had asked for someone to come to set with the code for the safe in order to open it, so we didn't have to do all that extra work. So my first interaction in person with Seth Kenny was during the prop truck search warrant.
Hang on just a second. So Mr. Kenny showed up and opened the safe for you.
Yes, he did.
And on that day that you were doing the search of the prop truck, do you recall what date it was?
It was October 27th, 2021.
And did Mr. Kenny kind of hang around there outside the prop truck and you were able to visit with him?
Yes.
Was Mr. Kenny cooperative with you?
Yeah, he was extremely cooperative.
Did Mr. Kenny bring you samples of live ammunition from PDQ props?
Yes, he did.
And did Mr. Kenny provide you access to text messages on his cell phone?
Yes, several times.
Did he provide you access to information on his tablet?
Yes.
What was the reason, or reasons rather, that you determined that conducting a search of PDQ props would be appropriate?
So throughout the investigation, we obviously had the unanswered question of where this live ammunition may have come from. During Hannah's secondary interview with me, I found that ammunition that was supplied to Rust actually came from three different sources. One of those sources...
Let's back up real quick before you get there. The interview that you did with Ms. Gutierrez on October 21st, 2021, did you have a conversation with her about who provided ammunition to the set?
Yes.
And who did she say provided ammunition?
Seth Kenny.
And then you conducted a follow-up interview with her in November.
Yes.
And that was when Mr. Bowles was there.
Correct.
And that's what you were going to start telling us about, right?
Yes.
Go ahead, proceed.
So in that secondary interview, Hannah had disclosed that there were actually three sources of ammunition that went onto the set of Rust. One of them, her original, being Seth Kenny from PDQ Arm and Prop. The second supplier was an individual named Billy Ray, and he was part of the business Spots and Props, I believe it is what it was. And then the third source of ammunition for Rust was herself.
How many boxes of dummy ammunition did Ms. Gutierrez tell you that she herself provided to the set of Rust?
So one, and then she had stated that she had brought other dummies and ammunition in gun belts.
Okay, so I think what we were discussing is what went into your thought process that caused you to decide that executing a search warrant on PDQ props would be appropriate.
Yeah, so during Hannah's secondary interview, it was identified at that point the actual physical location of PDQ, which was in Albuquerque, the 126 Monroe. And then subsequently after that, when I had gotten the statement from Thel, Thel had described that him and Seth Kenny had been training actors on another movie prior to this in another state, that they had used live ammunition. And so Thel had said that that ammunition somehow came back to New Mexico and then, you know, potentially gone back to PDQ, which is the reason that I used, along with Seth Kenny providing the fact that he did have live ammunition and use live ammunition on that set to draft that search warrant for PDQ.
Did you also have numerous conversations with Mr. Bowles?
Yes.
And were some of the statements that Mr. Bowles made also things that went into your decision to execute a search warrant there?
Yes.
What was the information you received from Mr. Bowles that caused you to turn your attention to Seth Kinney?
So from the beginning of this investigation, Mr. Bowles had made statements that he believed that there was sabotage on the set, although none of the individuals that I had interviewed shared the same sentiments. So none of the people that I had interviewed thought that this could be sabotage or, you know, that someone did this intentionally to Hannah. And so given the fact that Mr. Bowles had continuously told me about, you know, Seth Kinney and the fact that he may have supplied the live ammunition and that he was a supplier of ammunition is why we decided to take that path into investigating him.
Now, the interview that you conducted with Mr. Reed that went into your decision to apply for a search warrant, did Mr. Reed actually tell you specifically the kind of rounds that he recalled being on the set of 1883 that would now be in the possession of Seth Kinney?
Yeah, he described the live ammunition to have a semi-wad cutter top.
All right. Corporal, were you present in the courtroom for opening statements?
Yes.
Did you investigate Seth Kinney?
Yes, we did.
And based on Mr. Bowles' communications with you and other information, you actually applied for a search warrant and you conducted a search of PDQ props, correct?
Yes, I did.
And you spoke to Mr. Kinney numerous times, I think you testified to.
Many, many times.
And he was completely cooperative with you?
Yes, for over a year, I believe.
And in... Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, we had numerous conversations for an extended period of time.
Is there any particular reason that you didn't ask him for a DNA swab or a fingerprint sample?
Yes. So during my investigation and the interviews I conducted, there was never any testimony or reason to believe that Seth was ever on the set of Rust. Anything that was handled through him or any of the ammunition or anything that had been brought to set had been picked up by another person in Albuquerque or they had met outside of the set.
And just to be clear, Corporal, the live ammunition that you seized from PDQ Props, what did you do with it?
We submitted all the live ammunition for testing with the FBI.
And did you receive information that the live ammunition from PDQ didn't match the live ammunition on the set of Rust?
That's correct. It didn't match at all.
And isn't that in line with what Thel Reed himself told you about that ammunition being semi-wad cutter?
Yeah, so the statement that Thel had made about the type of ammunition that they were using matched what we found and what was provided by Seth Kinney.
So you found at PDQ exactly what Thel Reed told you you should find?
Yes.
And it did not match the live rounds on set?
That's correct.
Let's talk about the cell phone extractions that were done in this case. And let's go back to October 21st when we're on the set of Rust. Do you know why cell phones from every witness on the set weren't collected?
There was, I mean, obviously a lot of people that we were dealing with, and it's not standard practice, especially when we are still investigating, to just go and take people's possessions from them.
If I'm a witness to a crime, do you just get to come seize my cell phone?
No.
Do you get to put me in handcuffs?
No.
Do you get to put me in the back of a patrol unit?
No.
In fact, there was an extraction of Ms. Gutierrez's cell phone, correct?
That's correct.
And you didn't have to ask for a warrant. She consented to that.
She did consent.
And was there an extraction done of Mr. Baldwin's phone?
Yes.
And where was that done?
Suffolk PD in New York completed it.
And did Mr. Baldwin do that voluntarily, or did you have to execute a warrant?
So I had initially applied for a warrant for his phone, and it was approved here in New Mexico, but he was located in New York at the time. And so we ended up, actually the DA's office and Mr. Baldwin's attorneys ended up essentially getting his phone and doing his phone on consent as well.
Was a cell phone extraction done of the cell phone of Mr. Halls?
Yes, it was.
And did you have to get a warrant, or did Mr. Halls consent?
He consented.
Same thing with Ms. Zachary. Was there an extraction of her phone?
Yes.
Did she consent?
Yes, she did.
And Mr. Kinney shared with you the information from his phone that you asked for?
Yes, numerous times.
Is there a reason that the prop truck wasn't searched until October 27th?
Yes, so with the initial information that we had been given and that we responded to the day of the incident, the entire incident in itself had occurred inside the church. So that was our, you know, primary area that we were going to be investigating and processing and looking into, because that's where the incident occurred. Additional information that we had received was obviously involving the prop cart that Hannah and the props team was using, and that's why we, processed that prop cart as well. We didn't have information until later on that this prop truck had been involved in the props department and that we would potentially need to be looking for evidence there, which is why we didn't conduct that search until a few days later.
And Corporal, why wasn't the search of PDQ props done until the end of November?
Because the information that I had started receiving in terms of PDQ didn't come until, I believe it was November 9th. The statement that I was given from Thel, or my interview with Thel Reed, was November 17th. We had also received some evidence back from OMI November 22nd, and then I had another interview with Sarah, her secondary interview, on November 29th. So this is all stuff that I'm involved in and I'm conducting and doing myself. So November 30th was essentially the first day that I had available to do that search warrant, and I requested the search warrant that morning and got it done that afternoon.
Do criminal investigations involving 100 witnesses sometimes take time?
Absolutely, even ones that don't involve that many people.
Can you explain to the jury why latent fingerprint testing was not requested on the live rounds found on the set of Rust?
Yeah, absolutely. So during my interviews with all the people that were that I initially interviewed, there was statements from them that the gun that Alec Baldwin was using was taken from the church, that Dave Halls had taken it from the church, that he had handed that gun to Miss Reed, directed Miss Reed to essentially empty all the bullets from that gun. So in doing so, with Miss Reed emptying the bullets and examining them at that time, I know she touched them. I know her DNA or potentially her prints are going to be on those bullets. So it didn't make sense for us to DNA or latent test that round, because I know who touched it, and she wasn't the only one that touched it after that. In addition to that, the other live rounds that were found in, you know, gun belts, the box or the ammo box and the cart had all been handled by several people during this movie set, especially after the shooting. I had gotten statements that they had been handled by several different people. And not only that, but the gun belts that contained the live ammunition were said to have come from another set. And so for us, and in speaking with the DA's office, as well as the FBI, our representative from the FBI, it didn't make sense. It would be a test that just wouldn't yield anything that we were looking for.
And why wasn't DNA testing requested on the live rounds or the spent casing?
The spent from the gun?
From the set, yes. I'm sorry, the spent casing from the gun or the live rounds from the set of Rust. My apologies.
I'm sorry, you're saying why wasn't
DNA testing requested?
Okay. Essentially for the same reason, because of because of all the various people that had claimed to handle these rounds.
And did you also hear in previous testimony about FBI policies?
Yes.
And were you notified of those policies during the course of your investigation?
Yes, I was.
So if you had requested it, they would have refused?
Correct. And we did have that discussion with our FBI representative who was assigned to the case here in Santa Fe.
Now, we understand from previous testimony that you sent the gun that was being used by Mr. Baldwin to the FBI for testing. Is that correct?
Yes, we did.
And prior to the testing being done with the mallet, were you notified that that testing could potentially result in damage to the gun?
Yes.
And what was the reason that you proceeded with the testing anyway?
We proceeded with the testing because Mr. Baldwin had made statements that he didn't pull the trigger, and I think his exact statement was that the gun just went off. So we needed to figure out how to disprove that theory or that statement, and that was the way that was proposed to us and what the FBI could do.
On October, I'm going to go through and I'm going to play some videos of your statements with Ms. Gutierrez at this time. And on October 21st, 2021, did you have a conversation with Ms. Gutierrez when she was still on set before she was taken to the police station?
Yeah, we had some brief discussion.
Okay. And Your Honor, if it's acceptable, some of these videos, the first one isn't that long, but some of these videos are rather lengthy, and so I'd like to play them from counsel's table.
Sure.
Instead of standing.
Okay. How long are they?
The first one I think is about 8 minutes. The second one, off the top of my head, I want to say is about an hour. And the last one is between 2 and 3 hours.
All right, we'll probably take a break after the second one, the one that's an hour, okay?
More raw courtroom audio from the Rust Alex Baldwin movie shooting trial is on the way.
Press subscribe so you don't miss a moment.
From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.